This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 136, Ipsus. In the last two episodes, we covered the rise of our new neighbors in India, Samrat Chandragupta Maurya and the Maurya Empire, and how he warred with Seleucus and the Greco-Macedonian satraps of the far eastern provinces to win dominance over much of what used to be the Eastern Persian Empire, extending Indian rule to the western side of the Hindu Kush. Before that, we covered the ongoing Fourth War of the Diadochoi as Antigonus Monophthalmos and his son Demetrius Polyocrates battled Ptolemy, Cassander, and Lysimachus for dominance in the west. Both episodes left off in the same place. In 302 BCE, all of the major successors to Alexander the Great had declared themselves kings, some were declared gods, and it really looked like Antigonus and Demetrius might seize control of the western half of Alexander's crumbling empire. Demetrius had soundly defeated Ptolemy on Cyprus and was working his way north through Greece, while Antigonus, now 80 years old, maintained control over Syria and kept an eye on Ptolemy. That's when Cassander, still formally the regent of Macedon, played his trump card. He cut a deal with Lysimachus in Thrace, sent a few thousand Macedonian soldiers, and the Lysimachid army crossed the Sea of Marmara to invade Anatolia, left undefended by the Antigonids. This forced Antigonus to turn his army around and head north, which created an opening for Ptolemy to invade from the south. The Egyptian army crossed the Sinai, and just as Egyptian armies had been doing for most of the preceding millennium, marched north through Palestine and Phoenicia. Antigonus ordered his son to return from Greece with the rest of their army in order to make a stand, but neither the one-eyed father nor the city-besieging son could move fast enough to take action that year. By the time they all had their troops on the same continent, winter snows were falling in the Taurus Mountains, forcing both the Antigonid and Lysimachid armies to find winter quarters. Further south, Ptolemy didn't have to worry quite as much about winter, but he had heard rumors that Lysimachus was defeated in battle, so the king in Egypt decided to hold off on any further advances. He negotiated a truce to end his siege of Sidon in Phoenicia, left part of his army in garrisons throughout the Levant, and returned to Alexandria near Egypt, which had finally been built up enough to become Ptolemy's capital. This meant he was too far away by the time he received the corrected report to be of any use in the coming battle. Rather than trying to get far enough north to help, Ptolemy elected to remain focused on southern Syria for the time being. Meanwhile, the Seleucid army was making its way slowly across West Asia, a much longer journey than any of the other combatants, made slower by the presence of nearly 500 war elephants, recently received from Chandragupta. These elephants, born and trained in warm, humid India, at most occasionally deployed in the foothills of the Hindu Kush or the Himalayas, were in for quite the surprise. Seleucus crossed into southern Cappadocia in early winter, and immediately broke for winter quarters, meaning the whole army, elephants and all, spent the winter in the same area where Xenophon's men froze to death a century earlier. The campaign of 302 was a dire threat to the Antigonids, but not necessarily a disaster. It was just the bitter reality of their new geopolitical situation. When the Persian Empire dominated everything, they rarely, if ever, had to deal with more than one major threat at a time. The odds of a rebellion, a Greek hegemonic league, or a steppe confederacy materializing simultaneously were always pretty low. Now that there were five major Hellenistic kingdoms in play, all competing with one another for the same goals, and all with significantly fewer resources than the Achaemenids enjoyed, they were bound to struggle with defending every front, and Antigonus was surrounded on all sides. Lysimachus advanced in a surprise attack, which allowed him to capture several unprepared cities in quick succession. But he wasn't willing to engage in a protracted siege. So the few cities that could hold out did, and Lysimachus moved on. When Antigonus brought his army north, Lysimachus avoided a direct confrontation until the season changed, bringing both armies to a halt. A majority of the soldiers Cassander had sent to aid Lysimachus also died when their ships went down in an early storm, further decreasing that threat. Ptolemy was being cautious in the Levant, and since so many of Cassander's troops were either in Anatolia or the ocean, Greece was relatively secure. The Antigonids could still fight back here. On top of that, even though his elephants were surely intimidating, Seleucus's arrival made for a very tempting opportunity in Antigonus's mind. If he could beat the Antipatrid, Lysimachid, and Seleucid armies all in one battle, one where they very well could kill both Lysimachus and Seleucus on the field, then opposition to Antigonid rule would collapse. Cassander wouldn't be able to defend Macedon any longer, and history proved that Egypt alone would not withstand the full force of a reunified empire. If Antigonus could pull off the right victory, he could effectively conquer everything from Sogdia and Drangiana to Macedon and Libya in one confrontation. Unfortunately, this is where we run into a problem with our sources. A lot of the Hellenistic period staples, like Justin or Appian, don't write about this period in detail. So they just mention that the battle happened. Polyaenus, often a treasure trove of military anecdotes, doesn't cover Ipsus for whatever reason. Although he has been and will continue to be a detailed and valuable source, this is the point where Diodorus Siculus's Bibliotheca starts to break down and we are left with only fragments. Plutarch is thus the only intact, detailed source we have, but he wrote a short biography of Demetrius Polyocrates, not a general political or military history. The life of Demetrius is focused much more on the titular king's personal behavior than the details of this battle. That said, even comparing this episode to Plutarch's Lives of Alexander or Artaxerxes II, it seems like the details of today's battle may already have been obscure by the 1st century CE. It's not impossible that the exact details were never publicized to the degree of other major battles in the first place. All that to say, we really don't know what happened in the first few months of 301 BC. In order to draw everyone together at this specific time and place, and it is an odd time and place. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. The allies, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander's brother Playstarchus, did not face off with the full Antigonid army until early summer, despite everyone being in central Anatolia as soon as spring broke. That leaves about 3 months of no information in the buildup, which is unfortunate because the location is baffling. The nearest settlement was a tiny village called Ipsus, somewhere near the western border between Lydia and Caria, depending on where exactly you want to draw that line. According to Plutarch, the nearest town of any note was Sunada, modern Shuhud, in Turkey, but even that was about 50 miles away and not a city. They were really in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by nothing in the southern Anatolian countryside. It may be as simple as this being the first place that both armies managed to run into one another with a suitable battlefield. Plutarch says that Demetrius found his father's eagerness for war, even in old age, concerning and inspiring, and both Lysimachus and Seleucus had to worry about threats from their north while they were away from home. Both sides wanted and should have been eager for a conclusive battle by that summer. Antigonus and Demetrius mustered around 40,000 Macedonian-style phalangites from a combination of their own Macedonian followers, Demetrius's Greek allies, Anatolian Greeks, and Western mercenaries. They were joined by about 30,000 peltasts and archers from the same sources. 10,000 cavalry, drawn largely from Anatolia and northern Syria, and 75 elephants, most of which were probably bought from India when Antigonus still controlled the upper satrapies. At 64,000 men, the allied infantry component was slightly smaller, and probably skewed more towards light skirmishers than heavy phalangites, in part because so many of Cassander's men died at sea. At least 9,000 came from Macedon, 20,000 from the Seleucids, and the rest came from Thrace and either further Antipatrid reinforcements or mercenaries. Diodorus's cavalry numbers are way off, but all of his other numbers make sense and broadly agree with Plutarch, who says they mustered just over 10,000 cavalry as well. But regardless of specifics, the allied cavalry was roughly equal to the Antigonids numerically. Lysimachus may have had a couple elephants of his own, though at this point they were probably getting old for battle, and dragging them back across the sea would have been a difficult proposition. However, that hardly mattered. At between 400 and 500 elephants, Seleucus provided plenty of war beasts to go around. Additionally, although they had proven singularly ineffective against Greek-style armies in the past, Seleucus was still the ruler of Iran and Mesopotamia, and had thus inherited the long-standing Achaemenid Hatru system when summoning his troops. That meant there was still a chariot component to his army, with 120 scythed chariots taking the field. If nothing else, the chariots served as a poignant reminder that Seleucus, rather than Antigonus, was master of the lands that Alexander had fought so hard to claim. Both sides had their strengths and weaknesses. The Antigonid cavalry was more experienced and better equipped for a powerful charge against the Seleucid horsemen, likely dominated by Persian-style horse archers and javelin throwers. The Antigonids also had a simple numerical advantage on the infantry side of things, even if it was slim. Lysimachus and Pleistarchus would play their part as commanders, but Seleucus brought the advantage to their side. Though they weren't as lethal against trained infantry as other options, the scythed chariots could still be highly disruptive if used correctly. And with more than a 5-to-1 advantage, the allies had overwhelming elephant superiority. In a very small amount of foreshadowing, the biggest flaw in the Antigonid strategy may have been that Antigonus himself was in charge. We have seen over the course of the last few episodes that all of the first-generation Diadochoi, Antigonus, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Pleistarchus in this case, tended to replicate the battle formation pioneered by Philip II and Alexander the Great. To their credit, this was a highly effective formation in battles against enemies that had rarely, if ever, encountered it before, and employed different formations of their own. Philip's Macedonian phalanx were not designed to fight one another, and literally every leading faction on the early Hellenistic battlefields were not only familiar with it, but experts in this specific form of warfare. By contrast, several of the most successful battles we've seen since Alexander's death featured one side or the other breaking with tradition and altering the layout of their lines, Demetrius Polyocrates, in particular, has achieved many of his greatest successes by doing just that. However, the father, rather than the son, was in charge of the Antigonid forces at Ipsus. So both sides deployed near-identical mirror lines. Phalanx in the middle, a screen of light infantry out in front and around the flanks, light cavalry on the left, heavy cavalry including royal guards on the right, and elephants in front of everyone. On the Antigonid side, Demetrius took the royal position on the right side cavalry, the place where Alexander had always preferred to fight. Antigonus himself took a leaf out of the old Persian playbook and positioned himself and his personal guard directly behind the center of the main phalanx. And lest you think this was cowardly, remember, Antigonus was about 80 years old at this point. It was surprising for him to be on the battlefield at all. Seleucus's son made his first recorded appearance in combat as commander of the allied left flank, facing off directly with Demetrius. Especially with someone as prestigious as the Seleucid prince taking command, some historians have suggested that the allied left was reinforced with additional cavalry to counter Demetrius's larger wing. We don't know where the other allied commanders were positioned, but I can make some inferences based on Diodorus's wording and traditional roles as seen in Alexander's wars. Seleucus had the most prestigious kingship in the alliance as ruler of Babylon, and the right-wing cavalry was typically the most prestigious command. Plutarch at least implies this as well, by portraying Seleucus as making decisions about the cavalry in the midst of battle. I would guess that Playstarchus had command of the phalanx, since he was sent originally as an infantry commander by Cassander. That leaves Lysimachus, who probably would have complained about yielding choice commands to both Seleucus and his son under normal circumstances. But Diodorus mentions, quote, "The elephants of Antigonus and Lysimachus fought as though nature had matched them in both courage and strength." If Lysimachus did bring elephants from Thrace, there is no chance that it was a sufficient elephant corps to go toe-to-toe with the Antigonid animals. So I would guess that in exchange for the cavalry command going to Seleucus's family, Lysimachus was given direct command of the 100 or so strong elephant vanguard. This means that Lysimachus led the initial charge as elephant warred with elephant and the javelin throwers on their backs battled one another. While the elephants fought, Demetrius began his charge, making an arc out around the elephant battle and slammed into Antiochus's cavalry. Likely outnumbered and more lightly equipped, Antiochus's horsemen were forced to retreat. Unbeknownst to Demetrius, this was probably part of the plan. We don't have any confirmed sources stating that this was a feigned retreat on Antiochus's part, but for some reason Seleucus had held most of his elephants in reserve, or at least deployed them outside the main battlefield, and we don't know why. The most likely explanation comes here with the battle between Antiochus and Demetrius on the outer flank. Likely employing an early version of the famed Parthian shot, Antiochus's light cavalry could have turned around and fired some arrows or javelins back to encourage Demetrius's chase as they got further and further away from the main field. While Demetrius chased Antiochus, the allied infantry was free to clash with their Antigonid counterparts uninterrupted by cavalry attacks from the rear. Of course, Demetrius did eventually realize what was happening and attempted to turn around, only to find that 300 elephants were deployed between his cavalry and the rest of the battle. Not only did the towering animals topped with archers and javelins of their own present a formidable military obstacle, but they tended to just plain scare the horses, disrupting cavalry by their very presence. This left the right flank of the Antigonid phalanx completely exposed, and Seleucus's cavalry had yet to do anything. Rather than charging in and goring men and horses alike, Seleucus had his troops ride back and forth around the rear and the exposed flank, constantly threatening a charge but never acting on it. The goal wasn't to deal maximum casualties, but to instill fear. If they were afraid, Seleucus would never even need to risk his men because the Antigonids would just flee or surrender, and anybody who surrendered to Seleucus could be taken prisoner or be made a turncoat and used to build up the Macedonian population of Seleucus's budding colony cities. Antigonus tried to rally his men from the rear, but morale crumbled and the phalanx went with it. As Antigonid fighters turned and fled, the allied peltasts and skirmishers pushed through their ranks. Antigonus and his bodyguards were caught up in a steady tide of tens of thousands of retreating soldiers. Seleucus's cavalry was still riding along the sides and rear, hurling javelins and arrows, as were the allied skirmishers. Trapped and besieged by projectiles, it was only a matter of time. Multiple javelins met their mark, and Antigonus Monophthalmos died. His son was unable to rescue him, and the allies were victorious. I think it is fair to give Antigonus his final rites. King Antigonus Monophthalmos, the One-Eyed, was 80 years old and still commanding armies from the battlefield. Though he was not the ruler of Persia at the time of his death, he had previously been the strategos of Asia for 10 years, 5 with direct control over Persia, Babylon, and Media. In the aftermath of the Battle of Ipsus, Demetrius was only able to recover 5,000 infantry and 9,000 cavalry from the remains of his father's army. The rest were dead, wounded, captured, or running out into the countryside. The survivors that banded together fled northwest to the port of Ephesus to arrange passage to Athens, where Demetrius was still well-liked, had friends, and the Antigonid fleet. The residents of Ephesus were afraid that he had come to ransack their massive temple of Artemis, but Demetrius was in such a rush that he didn't even try. Instead, they put out to sea immediately. As they sailed through the Cyclades, Demetrius discovered that he was now banned from Athens. In fact, the Athenians had voted to just ban any and all kings, while the Diadochoi finished working this mess out. He still had allies within the city, but with Antigonid power broken, the Athenian assembly didn't want to risk incurring Cassander's wrath any more than necessary. One of Demetrius's wives who had been left there was escorted to Megara and awaited news from Demetrius on where to meet him. All over Greece, Antigonid garrisons were being expelled or turning themselves over to Cassander. Corinth continued to resist, as did a few smaller cities, but it was only a scattering across the peninsula. Likewise, Ephesus and a few other eastern Greek cities stuck to the Antigonid cause, as did Tyre and Sidon in Phoenicia, and some islands in the Cyclades. Demetrius was joined in this state of exile by his brother-in-law, the exiled prince Pyrrhus of Epirus, who had fought by Demetrius's side during the Battle of Ipsus. Pyrrhus was just 18 years old at the time, and he was probably starting to lament hitching his horse to the Antigonid chariot right about now. However, he was given command of the remaining Antigonid loyalists in Anatolia, while Demetrius went to Corinth. The remaining Diadochoi started to divvy up the Antigonid kingdom. Syria, north of Damascus or thereabouts, went to Seleucus, as did Cappadocia and central Phrygia. Caria, Lydia, coastal Phrygia, and Bithynia Pontus went to Lysimachus. Greece fell back under Cassander's rule. Ptolemy was just left harassed in Egypt with an implied invitation to use his large navy to clean up Demetrius's remaining loyalists in the Aegean if he saw fit. Back in Corinth, Demetrius used his remaining political capital and wealth to recruit a small mercenary fleet and began a series of raids against Lysimachus's coast, where the Anatolian and Thracian Greeks still largely supported Antigonid rule. According to Polyaenus, Lysimachus recognized that he didn't have popular support among his own army and executed 5,000 of his own men on suspicion that they threw a battle in Demetrius's favor. It was a campaign of ambushes and lightning sieges against cities where he still had popular support. Thanks to the Antigonid fleet that was largely unaffected at Ipsus, Demetrius was able to blockade the Hellespont, greatly disrupting the economies of both the Lysimachid kingdom and pro-Cassander Greeks. The chaos created an opportunity for an inland Thracian revolt against Lysimachus, with Odrysian support as well. In search of aid, Lysimachus and Ptolemy exchanged daughters in a marriage pact. One of Lysimachus's daughters apparently married Ptolemy Soter's son, also named Ptolemy. In fact, one of two of Ptolemy's sons named Ptolemy, while Ptolemy's daughter, Arsinoe, married Lysimachus himself. We're going to deal with the Ptolemies for a while, so I hate to say this, but keep Ptolemy, and Arsinoe in mind going forward. In response, and in order to cut down on his ever-growing number of enemies, Demetrius reached out to Seleucus to secure his own marriage pact. Seleucus married Demetrius's daughter Stratonike, who gave him a much firmer claim to legitimacy in Syria than just outright conquest. However, the intricacies of the Seleucid court will have to wait. Next time, we will return to the east and figure out what exactly it meant to be the Seleucid Empire. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.